This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Pete Docter, director of the new Disney-Pixar animated film Inside Out. Inside Out imagines what goes on in a child's mind ruled by competing emotions. When the film begins, an 11-year-old girl named Riley is uprooted from her home in Minnesota because her father started a new company in San Francisco. The usually joyful girl becomes sad and angry that she's been forced to leave the house, friends, and hockey team she loves. Much of the film takes place inside her head, where there's a control room operated by five characters who personify her primary emotions. Joy is voiced by Amy Poehler, anger by Lewis Black, fear by Bill Hader, disgust by Mindy Kaling, and sadness by Phyllis Smith. In this flashback scene, Riley's in her high chair at the kitchen table with her parents. Her father, voiced by Kyle MacLachlan, is feeding her broccoli. The five emotions in her mind's headquarters are figuring out how to deal with this dreaded food.
Here we go. All right, open.
This looks new.
Think it's safe?
What is it?
Okay, caution. There is a dangerous smell, people. Hold on, what is that?
This is disgust. She basically keeps Riley from being poisoned, physically and socially.
That is not brightly colored or shaped like a dinosaur. Hold on, guys. It's broccoli! Yucky!
Well, I just saved our lives. Ooh. Yeah, you're welcome.
Riley, if you don't eat your dinner, you're not gonna get any dessert.
Wait, did he just say we couldn't have dessert?
That's anger. Cares very deeply about things being fair.
So that's how you want to play it, old man? No dessert? Oh, sure. We'll eat our dinner right after you eat this.
Right, right. Here comes an airplane.
Oh, airplane. We got an airplane, everybody.
And, of course, the airplane is the spoon that the father's feeding into the child's mouth. Pete Docter, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film. I know the film was inspired in part by being the parent of a daughter who was 11 at the time you were thinking of making the film. What kind of mood changes were you seeing in your daughter, competing emotions that she was obviously experiencing that you were trying to decode that helped lead to the movie?
Yeah, well, we were lucky in a case of our daughter. She was pretty tame compared to some stories I've heard, but she definitely went from being kind of a goofy, high-energy little kid to being much more kind of quiet and laid back. And, you know, I sort of realized the days of playing with dolls and trains on the floor were over, and that's kind of what led into this movie.
What gave you the idea of personifying five emotions, joy, anger, sadness, fear, and disgust, and having them at the controls, in the control room of the child's brain?
Yeah, we called it headquarters, which is where they work. And the idea kind of started with me just thinking about what would be fun to see in animation. You know, what have I not seen that we could
do? I'm going to stop you for a second. I shouldn't tell you this because it shows how stupid I am. I just got the joke of headquarters. Because it's like, in the film, it's like they're at headquarters. And of course, it's like the headquarters of the brain. But right, it's headquarters. Got it. Thank
right.
you. I hope your audiences are smarter than I was with that one.
There's a lot of layers in this movie.
Yeah.
So. I was just thinking about, like, okay, I've seen a lot of movies about all these different subjects, including, for some reason, I got thinking about the human body and realizing, well, I've seen, like, traveling through the bloodstream and into the, you know, stomach and things. Well, what if we did this in the mind as opposed to the brain? So instead of blood vessels and dendrites, what if it was consciousness and dream production? And that would allow us to have characters that represent emotions. And that felt like, man, that's exactly what animation does best. Strong, opinionated, caricatured personalities. And that just got me excited.
You boiled it down to joy, anger, sadness, fear, and disgust. It seems to me if you were Jewish and perhaps Catholic, guilt would have been a character.
I'm not actually sure if guilt is an emotion. In fact, that was at the very beginning of this process, we realized, man, we really don't know very much about the subject, so we better do some research. And we started looking around online. We found some scientists think that there are basically three emotions. Others went up to 27. Others had 16, somewhere in the middle. So we were kind of left with no definitive answer to our basic question, how many are there? Dr. Paul Ekman, who worked in San Francisco, still does, which is where Pixar Animation Studios is, he had early in his career identified 6. That felt like a nice manageable number of guys to design and write for. It was anger, fear, sadness, disgust, joy, and surprise. And as I was sort of doodling, I was thinking, surprise and fear, probably fairly similar. So let's just lose surprise. And that left us with 5.
So part of what Paul Ekman does is like decode facial expressions to try to understand what a person is feeling and how it's expressed. Did you study his decoding of faces expressing emotion?
Well, that's actually how I got to know his work, because back on Toy Story, I was a supervising animator on the first Toy Story, and read about his work and identifying these basic facial expressions. It was interesting because he said there are so many muscles in the face that could be used in combination with each other that just are not. And that's because basic human emotion is sort of hardwired into us as people. And so some of his early work was traveling to Papua New Guinea to find tribes that had no outside contact at all, show them photographs of expressions and tell them stories and say, okay, if your mother died, what kind of face would you make? And he found that they identified the same expressions that we would hear in the United States. And so it's fairly worldwide. That was pretty fascinating and a little revolutionary at the time, apparently.
Describe how you drew Joy, who was voiced by Amy Poehler.
Joy we thought of as kind of an explosion or a spark. You know, she's like an outwardly directed person who's just always moving and she's full of energy. And even the way she looks, if you look at her up close, and this is true of all the emotions in the film, we wanted them to look not like little people. So they're not made of skin or flesh. They're made out of energy. And so they have these tiny little particles that sort of roil and move. And that we felt was a good way of representing that.
And Mindy Kaling is the voice of disgust. And I've been trying to imagine what it was like for her to get the call saying, we'd like you to personify disgust.
Yeah, I know. We kind of worried about that one. We did say, okay, it's disgust. She's disgusted. She's not disgusting. And that kind of assuaged her fears a little bit. But she came in. We gave her a pitch. She was actually pretty key to decoding some elements of the story. We were really wrestling with these two different themes of growing up and then embracing sadness, which we felt were kind of separate. But I don't know. I had an intuition that they could somehow be connected. I pitched her the story. And as I turned around, because I was pitching kind of off some visuals on the computer, I turned around and she's crying. And I thought, oh, no, what? Did she get like a bad text or something? You know, she was really responded emotionally. And she said, I'm sorry. I just think it's really beautiful that you guys are making a story that tells kids that it's difficult to grow up and it's okay to be sad about it. And that we were like, quick, write that down, you know, because that was really what we were trying to say.
It is the kind of moral of the story that if you cut off sadness, you're not going to feel anything when you're sad, and that that's the worst thing of all, and that sadness is the way to be able to communicate what you're really feeling with other people.
Yeah. One of the other experts we consulted with, this guy named Dacher Keltner, he was big on sadness as a community bonding. I think is the word he uses. Like, you know, if you're sad, it's a way of connecting with other people. And we, a lot of times, we sort of feel embarrassed by being sad and we go off by ourselves to hide and cry by ourselves. But really, it's a way of reestablishing relationship.
Well, people discourage us from being sad. It's like, oh, smile. Oh, cheer up. And I think it's often that way with children. I know when I was a child and I wasn't smiling and I was walking down the street, there'd always be a stranger coming up to me saying, come on, smile. And I thought, like,
yeah,
get out of my face, you know, like, leave me alone. But
it is one of those weird social things. You're right. Even as parents, we say, oh, don't be sad. You know, come here. We'll distract you with some ice cream or something. And I don't know if that's always the best thing. But it's certainly you understand why people do it.
So did you imagine when you were making this film, psychologists and parents using the film to explain to children what their own emotions were, and to help tell children, like, it's okay to be sad. Tantrums aren't very helpful. We know you have anger, but, you know, you have to kind of mix that with the other emotions. Did you think of this as a kind of, like, teaching film?
No. In fact, I know, like, for a lot of people, that's kind of a bad word, right? You don't want to have a lecture. We were really, as I said, the thing that attracted me to it was the fun and the chance to take people places that everyone was sort of familiar with on one level, but had never seen visualized, you know, things that we get to explore in the film, like why songs get stuck in your head and long-term memory. And what was that weird dream I had last night? Where did that come from? You know, so this was our chance to really bring all that stuff to life and explore it in a fun way. However, as we went into it, I at certain points almost felt like I couldn't move forward because I really wanted to make sure that the science was as correct as it could be. Because, you know, I think you just don't want to make a film that scientists go to and roll their eyes at, you know. On the other hand, this is the mind. There's a lot of different ways to kind of slice that and look at it. So it was a tricky film to balance. In the end, I think you're right. We've already had discussions with people who feel as though the film has really helped them. There's one story that's pretty amazing. A guy who we work with, and we had screened the film for our friends and family along the way just to make sure it was working and it wasn't too complex, you know, especially for younger kids. Luckily, they not only got it, but this guy came back the next day and he said, I got to tell you this story. My son has been taking swimming lessons and he's been afraid to dive off the diving board. It's just too high and he's scared, so he hasn't been able to do it. Yesterday, after seeing the film, we went to lessons and he dove off the diving board. And everybody said, yeah, that's great. How did you do it? And he said, well, I just felt like fear had been driving and I asked him to step aside. And for us, we were sort of blown away. Not only did he get the film, but it was actually making an impact in his life. That was like the ultimate receipt.
There is sadness in the story in Inside Out because the 11-year-old girl is forced to move from her home in Minnesota. Her father has a startup, and mm-hmm. it's in San Francisco. So the family, you know, this 11-year-old and her mother and father have to move to San Francisco, and she's leaving behind the house that she loves, the little lake she loves to skate on, her hockey team, her friends. And they moved to San Francisco. The house is kind of, you know, run down and she's just like so sad at having left everything behind. And I think that's such a scary thought for a parent, you know, that the parent is making the change that has to be made, but it's going to create such sadness in the child.
Yeah. Yeah, we were looking for a way to represent adulthood and the passing into adulthood. And I think for me personally and a lot of the folks that I work with, childhood is kind of a sacred, special kind of point in time that has a real joy and purity to it. And we sort of long on a daily basis to reach back and kind of grab onto that in some way. So this idea of moving seemed like a good way to sort of represent that metaphorically. It also is something for me personally, when I was in fifth grade, so about 11, my folks moved us to Denmark. And so not only did I have all new friends and all new surroundings, I didn't even understand what they were talking about, which was very difficult and kind of started me, I think, on my path to animation. It was a lot easier to draw people than to talk and interact with them. So,
why did your family move to Denmark?
My father was working on his PhD on Danish choral music, the Danish choral music of Carl Nielsen. So over there to do research.
So were you very sad?
I remember kind of falling into this melancholy of, yeah, and Denmark as a country, there's not a lot of sun. I think there's like statistically like 20 days a year that are sunny. The rest of the time it's cloudy, and it kind of has that feeling for me in being fifth grade. Of course, it's very beautiful. You go back now and I see it in a totally different light. But at the time, it was a kind of a dark dream. I remember kind of feeling as though I was walking in slow motion a little bit. I think in part because that's the age when you're suddenly aware of all the social responsibilities and connections. And wait, am I wearing the right clothes? Is this cool? Did I say the wrong thing? You know, up to that point, you just kind of blissfully go through your life, and things are relatively simple, it seems.
Did you adapt?
Yeah, I think by the end, I mean, weirdly, like, I remember coming home with splitting headaches for maybe 3 weeks where I guess my brain was trying to figure out what they were talking about. And by the end of the year, I was fairly fluent, although, of course, it's all gone now. So, you know, I think by the end of the time, if we had stayed longer, I probably would have been fine. Then we moved back to Minnesota, and then I was out of step with those kids. So it was kind of a double whammy.
So I've read that there was a point at which you were supposed to show part of the film to John Lasseter, the founder of Pixar, but you had nothing you really wanted to show him yet. So you described what you were planning to do, but you had nothing to show, and you felt like a real failure at that point. So how did you handle that emotionally? Like, what got you through that feeling of maybe this isn't going to work?
Well, the film initially, we had decided to pair joy with fear because, I don't know about you, for me, fear was a major motivator in junior high. So we thought there's probably some good stuff there, some good humor and identifiable stuff. As the film went on, we had developed all these great scenes that were really funny, but in the third act, it wasn't adding up to anything. And, you know, you want Joy now, having learned her lesson, to go back to headquarters to do something that she would never have been able to do in the first act. But what exactly is that? I don't know. And at this time, we had spent almost 3 years working on the film. And I knew that there was an upcoming screening where not only were we going to show it to everybody else at the studio, we also needed to move into production. So there was kind of this really heavy pressure that whatever we were going to show had to be good enough to move into actual production. And yet I was sitting there in editorial going, this is not working. I'm a failure. I mean, these other films were flukes. I don't know what I'm doing. I should just quit. What would I miss? I'd miss my house and I'd miss going to work. But I think the thing that I realized I would miss most is probably similar to everybody, which is your friends. And I thought about it and I realized the friends that I feel the deepest connection with are the friends that, yeah, I've had good times with, but there are also people that I've been angry with, that I've had sadness alongside them. I've been scared for them. And it's sort of hit me that the very subject matter of the film that I'm dealing with is the key to the most important thing in our lives, and that's our relationships. And so we had done all this research showing the job of each individual emotion. You know, fear keeps you safe. It deals with uncertainty. Anger is about fairness. If it feels that you're getting ripped off or taken advantage of, that's when anger comes up. Sadness deals with loss. And I suddenly had this new revelation, it felt like to me, that those are all true, but the real deeper reason we have emotions is to connect us together. And that felt big to me. And I suddenly had an idea that we needed to get fear out of there and sadness connected with joy. And I ran back. I called the producer Jonas Rivera and Ronnie Del Carmen, who's our co-director. And we met that Sunday night and I kind of went through this whole spiel with them. And I was kind of expecting them to sink into their chairs and, you know, bury their hands in their faces because the pressure was pretty great. Instead, they totally lit up. And so the three of us went to John and to Ed and the rest of the we sort of call it the brain trust, you know, other filmmakers. So the cool thing was they very quickly understood why and were totally on board why this new thing was an improvement. So they got on board and we moved on. It was a scary moment, but it was the right call in the long run.
Can I point out that I think the real hero of the story you just told was fear? Because seriously, it was fear of failure that got you to realize that sadness had to be more of a main character in the movie.
That is true.
So
that is true. Maybe there's another movie in there where fear is the hero.
Let's pay our respects to fear.
Yeah.
Let's give fear its
great
props.
Motivator.
Yeah. But, you know, you said that, like, fear was such an important motivator when you were in junior high school. Isn't it still?
Oh, yeah. More than I'd probably care to admit. And in part, that's good. But then, like any emotion, and this is something we learned from the research as well, there are positive and negative aspects to all of these.
Yes. You haven't had a film that failed, but and I hope you never do. But I always imagine what it's like when I do see a movie that's pretty bad, and I think somebody spent years of their life working on this, and it's not good. Imagine how they must feel. No one's going to go see it. Do you live in fear of that? That someday you'll spend like 5 years making an animated film and it won't be good, and that's like 5 years of your life.
Absolutely. You know, but the truth is, at some point, our films, almost every single one of them, are really bad. And it's largely hats off to John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, who have set up a system whereby they're expecting it. They're expecting us to make mistakes. And they've set up a process that allows us to correct for that and do it again and iterate. So I think that's a real key to the films that we've made.
What is that process?
Well, what we do is we have a script, of course, but for us, writing is also like storyboarding. It's drawing. And so we will cut all of those drawings together with music, sound effects, and dialogue, and we screen this kind of stick figure version of the film. So we can sit with Lee Unkrich and Andrew Stanton and all the other folks and experience what the film is going to be like. And then we go away into a room, and we talk about what worked and what didn't. And then we take all those findings and we do that whole process again. And it's about a 3-month process every screening. And that way we have 7 or 8 chances at the film before we have to actually build the models, build the sets, do the animation and all of that. So I think that's a real key to the way we make films.
So now that the movie is opening, are you going to see Inside Out with audiences and see what the reaction is like in just like a theater of random people?
Yeah, oh yeah, that's one of the real joys for me is going out and watching. And usually I'm not watching the screen. I'm kind of sitting and looking off to the side, spying on people to see what they react to. Because it's, as Joe Ranft used to say, you know, animation is like telling a joke and waiting for 3 years to see if anyone laughs.
Pete Docter directed and co-wrote the new Disney Pixar animated film Inside Out. Rock critic Ken Tucker says one of the year's most striking new recordings comes from Shamir, a singer-songwriter in his early 20s from Las Vegas. Ken says the artist, whose full name is Shamir Bailey, has come up with a sound full of energy and optimism.
You took me over to the dark side. The thrill was good. Together we stood like a modern day Bonnie and Clyde. We were staying around. Forget the bad things we done. We were fit for survival. No books but the Bible held out with a gun.
Shamir has a voice that soars, floating in and around the electric keyboards and percussion. It's a voice that sounds knowing and sly, ripe for pleasure and a good time. Working most frequently with disco, dance, house music beats, his songs invariably open out into pure pop pleasure.
Stranger kisses and pixie dust, crazy nights that's filled with lust. I don't know you.
Before this album, Ratchet, Shamir put out an EP called Northtown, named after the area where Shamir grew up, in North Las Vegas, a more rural area. He lived closer to a pig farm than to a casino. When I first heard Shamir, his voice reminded me of Sylvester, creator of the great 1978 disco anthem, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. Like Sylvester, Shamir frequently projects an unbridled optimism, an assertion of confidence that has nothing to do with arrogance, but rather a firm insistence upon living life on his own terms.
I've been trying to find a reason to keep us together. Try to make up my bed of lies and call the now my shelter.
The music here benefits from its stripped-down quality. Working with producer Nick Sylvester, Shamir made the most of what was undoubtedly a low budget, using synthesized keyboards and percussion. I think Shamir is going to appeal to a lot of people once they dig deeper into his music, after the shock of pleasure there is to get from his singing. In his lyrics, Shamir rejects cynicism, irony, smug knowingness, negativity. As he sings on the swirling ballad Darker, it doesn't get darker unless you expect it to.
We're just shells that earth dwells, but our souls flow to new dimensional cells. But the love we leave is our
can't contain the truth, Shamir sings over and over at the conclusion of that song, Darker. Part of Shamir's truth is that he likes all kinds of music. I mean, how could I not like a guy who also covers country tunes such as Miranda Lambert's The House That Built Me and Kacey Musgrave's Merry-Go-Round? It's this range of taste that further suggests Shamir's potential to become a pop star to all people. Striking voice and androgynous demeanor come across as all-inclusive. Shamir's presentation, from his songs to his look, are all about inviting you in, leaving no one out. It's as pure a form of pop stardom ambition as we've had recently. Just want to be great, he sings toward the end of his debut album, adding, is that such a crime? No, Shamir, it is not.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. Coming up, Joel Bourne discusses his new book about the challenges of feeding a growing global population. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Got my hand in the crowd, and I'm never coming down. Got my hand in the crowd, and I'm never coming down.
In the 1960s, the farmers of Egypt grew enough wheat to feed the country and export some to its neighbors. But But as the country's population grew, its farmers couldn't keep up, and Egypt is now the world's largest importer of wheat. When international food prices spiked in 2008, there were bread riots in the streets of Cairo. Our guest, Joel Bourne, says Egypt's problems illustrate a terrifying fact facing all humanity. The world is running out of food. In his new book, Bourne chronicles the trends making it likely we'll see more hunger and malnutrition in coming decades. While the Earth's population is growing rapidly, our ability to feed it is undermined by a loss of arable land due to climate change, growing water shortages, the use of valuable farmland to grow biofuels, and the fact that many of us eat so much meat, which is a highly inefficient way to use the grain we grow. Bourne says there are some promising developments and ways to meet the threat, but time is running out. Joel Bourne got a degree in agronomy before becoming a journalist. He's a contributing writer to National Geographic and has written for Audubon, Science, and Outside Magazine. His new book is called The End of Plenty: The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Well, Joel Bourne, welcome to Fresh Air. You grew up in rural North Carolina, a little town, and you write that you always thought you'd be a farmer. Why? What appealed to you about it?
Well, you know, my father, who was a small-town attorney, I always wanted to be a farmer. He actually farmed my grandfather's land when he came back from World War II. My grandfather discouraged him from doing that and made him go to law school. But he spent the bulk of his life and most of his, nearly all of his free time out working on the farm, where he would drag me with him. So I grew up working in tobacco, chopping cotton and peanuts, hunting and fishing in the streams around the farm. So when it became time for me to choose a college, I only picked one. I pretty much knew I was going to be a farmer. And so applied to one university, NC State, and got into the ag program in 1981.
So you decided not to become a farmer in the end. You write that, you know, you would have had to borrow a lot of money to get into a field that didn't appeal to you that much. What did you do instead?
Well, it was really funny. I graduated in 1985. It was the midst of the first great farm crisis in the United States, where crop prices were terribly low. And Willie Nelson and John Mellencamp and Neil Young were sponsoring Farm Aid. Their first Farm Aid concert was the year I graduated because so many farmers were going bankrupt. So I had taken some English classes and journalism classes and really liked it. I ended up traveling a lot after college, going to New Zealand, worked on a dairy farm there, went to Australia, worked on a big wheat farm there, and then into Indonesia, where I watched rice production throughout those beautiful rice paddies in Bali and Java. But when I got back home, as much as I loved the farm, I just couldn't find myself going back into farming. So I went and became a journalist instead.
You know, you write in the book that 80 to 90% of the calories we eat come from three crops, wheat, rice, and corn. And in the 1960s, there was this dramatic increase in agricultural yields that we call the Green Revolution. Just tell us the story in brief. What happened?
Well, it was very interesting. After World War II, there was a lot of hunger in the world. Up to 30% of the world's population was chronically malnourished. Mexico was having a real problem feeding its people. They were depending on more and more imports from the United States. So the Rockefeller Foundation, at the request of the Vice President of the United States, went down to Mexico to see if they could do anything about it. And at that time, a young plant physiologist named Norman Borlaug was working for DuPont, and they recruited him to go down and started a wheat breeding program in Mexico. First, to start to deal with wheat rust, which was the scourge, was decimating yields down there, and they were having difficult problems with it. So Borlaug went down and started this massive breeding program. And his goal initially was successful. I mean, he defeated wheat rust, developing a suite of genes that are still used in most commercial wheat varieties today. But in the meantime, he also developed a deal where he transformed wheat into this tall, wispy plant that tended to not yield so well and fall over, to this very short-stemmed plant that if you gave it enough nitrogen, enough phosphorus, enough water, it would yield like crazy. So he revolutionized, with these heavy input, chemical-intensive agriculture, our ability to feed ourselves. So even though population has nearly tripled since he started his program in the 1950s, you know, we have more than kept up with this massive influx of wheat. And his same techniques were used in the production of new types of rice, where they created dwarf rice varieties that did much the same thing and were equally successful in just explosive yield growth.
Okay, so applied science gives us enormous yields in food production and reduces hunger around the world, makes us healthier. But there were downsides. What were they?
There certainly were downsides. I mean, now we've got rampant fertilizer running into our wetlands and streams. We've created plants that thrive, but only under with these high input type of scenarios. So they need water, they need a lot of fertilizer, and they also need, because you're growing a lot of plants close together, they need a fair number of pesticides in order to keep things, insects and weeds at bay. All of these things end up in our waterways, end up in our watersheds. And now, of course, we're seeing dead zones at the end of the Mississippi every year, the size of New Jersey, Connecticut. You're seeing them all over the world. There's like something like 300 million square kilometers of coastal zones that are now every year dead zones because of this algal bloom that's fueled by all this fertilizer going off into the water. So that has led to an enormous cost.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, our guest is science writer Joel Bourne. His new book about the challenges of feeding a growing world population is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. So let's talk about some ways that we might deal with this challenge and some promising trends that you've identified. You know, decades ago, we had this green revolution, which dramatically increased the productivity of agriculture. And one thing, of course, would be terrific would be if that could happen again. And there's been this progress in genetically modifying seeds and plants. It's very controversial. They're banned in some countries. What's the prospect that that would give us an enormous increase in yield that will help us feed more people?
Well, this is part of the great conundrum that that Norman Borlaug mentioned when this technology sort of started coming in the 1970s. There was this great hope that the ability to transfer genes from all these different species would create this, you know, create another green revolution. It was going to save us from where we were heading in terms of population and demand. Unfortunately, even though there have been some environmental benefits to GMOs, and they haven't really caused the dramatic health or environmental damage that that some of the critics have been worried about, they haven't produced that much yield growth either. So conventionally bred crops are producing just as high yields as GMOs. We haven't seen any of this sort of dramatic rise that we saw during Borlaug's era, where we got a doubling, almost tripling of global yield production. It just hasn't happened. So many people are thinking, you know, maybe the yield switch is not one we can genetically manipulate. There's only a certain amount of sunlight coming into plants that can be converted into seed. Maybe we're starting to see the sort of yield cap. And even Borlaug himself said that the Green Revolution would only give us sort of 30 years before it would begin to play out. And almost on cue in 2000, 30 years after he won the Nobel Peace Prize, you started to see our yields start to flatten out. So we've had no yield growth in wheat and rice basically during the entire first of the 21st century.
Now, there have been some genetically modified seeds developed by corporations which have saved money, have allowed them to make some crops more resistant to certain pesticides, et cetera, but no big yield increases. But as the costs of genetic research has declined, more universities, more nonprofits are taking this on. Are there real prospects that you could find ways to modify plants and seeds to really increase productivity in some crops?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the great hopes that the scientists and these land grant universities and foundations will save us with this new technology. Unfortunately, even though it's now available to them because of the reduction of cost. I mean, you can now sequence a genome on a computer not much more powerful than your smartphone, according to one of the researchers I spoke to. It cost them $99, which is enormously affordable for them. And they have made wonderful strides. Researchers at UC Davis have developed a flood-resistant rice that can withstand 2 weeks of being inundated and still come back and produce a crop. This has been enormously popular and successful in Southeast Asia, where a lot of the rice is grown in very flood-prone areas. Now, the big sort of holy grail of the GMO nonprofits is to create something called C4 rice. This is a type of high-yielding rice that has the potential to, you know, boost rice yields by almost 50% by using the same amount of fertilizer, water, and all the inputs. But even though they're working very hard on it, it's still, according to the researchers I spoke to, 20 to 30 years from the farmer's fields. So again, this stuff is, all the potential of the genetic manipulation seems to be just out of our reach, just out of the farmer's hands in terms of yield. So we're going to have to solve this problem before those wonder seeds, those miracle seeds get to us.
You write about some other things, including what you called the Blue Revolution, the idea of dramatically expanding the farming of seafood, including farms in the ocean. What do you see there?
Well, this is a dream that Jacques Cousteau had back in the 70s, that we would stop being hunters and gatherers of the ocean, which is terribly inefficient, and actually becoming farmers of the sea. The focus here that I've written about is on these sort of novel new ways where aquaculture can really pump out an enormous amount of good, healthy protein with very little impact on the aquatic environment. So one of the examples was an offshore fish farm I visited down in Panama, where they're really in the deep water, 8 miles off the coast of Panama, off the Panama Shelf. If it's successful, and no one has yet made any money farming in the deep offshore waters. Most aquaculture farms are either in freshwater or they're very close to shore. But if he's successful, it could really open up vast swaths of the ocean to fairly low impact aquaculture that could pump out an enormous amount of good, healthy, low-fat, you know, protein to a world that desperately needs it.
What does a deep water fish farm look like? Is it like huge vertical nets out under the waves?
Oh, it's very cool. He's got like 8 or 12 of these huge fish pens that look like old gyroscopes we used to play with as children, and yet they're covered in Kevlar netting, and they sink. And they typically subsist about 60 feet below the surface of the ocean. So he had one hurricane that was like a Cat 4 hurricane that went through one of his test farms, didn't lose a single fish. You know, they're down deep below so the ocean energy won't tear them up. So it's an incredible thing. So I went diving in one of these things with this entrepreneur, O'Hanlon was his name. And it's an incredible experience. You're down there, you know, floating around a net pen with 30,000 fish, and yet they were all calm. They didn't seem stressed. It wasn't, you know, the water was incredibly clear. It just seemed like a wonderful way to grow this type of protein for the world.
Are there promising ideas in irrigation and water conservation that will help that?
You know, absolutely. I mean, we waste half the water we apply to crops in general. I mean, we're still using in many parts of the world this flood irrigation we've used since, you know, we started cutting ditches in the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia. So our current use of water is incredibly inefficient. However, I interviewed one of the fellows on the cusp of this, a Stanford engineering grad, who was developing this ultra cheap micro irrigation that he's selling to farmers in India and China. And again, this is stuff he's designed basically out of the same stuff we make these cheap plastic bags out of. He's got a couple of PVC tubes and a barrel at the end. And, you know, he can sell this stuff to farmers and get 90% water use efficiency out of it at very low cost.
So again, it applies water evenly to plants so you don't waste it? Is that the idea?
Yeah, essentially, it's like one of these. The company's called DripTech, and it's got one of these drip lines that has a little nozzle that goes to each plant. And so instead of, you know, wasting water, flooding it throughout the field, and half of it not even getting near the root zone, you know, you're applying just the right amount of water directly to the roots. Incredibly efficient, you know, and enormously water saving. And you're starting to see all kinds of water saving techniques starting to come about that. You know, as the price of water gets higher or as it gets more limited, you know, farmers are very adaptable. And there are good signs that we'll be able to at least ameliorate some of these water demands that are projected to increase.
As you look at this problem, how much of the challenge we face is a shortage of food as opposed to getting the income into the hands of the people who need it, and just managing the public policy mechanisms to make sure that people are fed?
Sure. Well, this is the great conundrum of the food crisis. Part of the problem is poverty, right? We've got half the world that lives on $2 a day and spends 60 to 70% of its income on food. The other part of the problem is growing income. So the world's getting richer. Our middle class in places like China and India are growing astronomically. And when they get more money, they typically eat higher things on the food web. In India, it's dairy. In China, it's pork. So, you know, this great demand for meat, which is expected to double literally within the next decade, is part of the issue because meat takes a lot more grain to produce a pound of meat than it does just eating the grain itself. So as people's incomes rise, we need to figure a way for countries that need better nutrition and can get that from meat to allow them to have that. Whereas countries like the United States and Europe, well, we eat way too much meat. I mean, our meat-centric diet is scheduled to, and high fat, high sugar, high salt, is scheduled to make half of the U.S. population either diabetic or pre-diabetic by 2020. So there are parts of the world that eat way too much of meat protein and parts of the world that don't eat enough. So balancing those out, and I think, and you know, it's already starting, you're already starting to see that because people realize in the United States the health consequences of poor eating habits, and they're trying to adjust. So there is this push. Because, you know, you don't want to keep the world poor just so they can eat lower on the food chain. You want everybody to move up the ladder. But as we do, we're also going to have to adjust consumption. So these are the two swords. You either increase production or you reduce demand. You reduce consumption by eating lower on the food chain. And, of course, the big question, of course, is how much we can reduce our population or limit population growth between now and the time when the food really starts to get scarce.
You ever going to be a farmer?
You know, that's interesting. Maybe after journalism takes a dive, I'll consider going back. I think I'd be better writing about good farmers than trying to farm myself. But it is a noble profession and one that is critically important, and I think one that we ignore at our own peril.
Joel Born is the author of the new book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.